Good morning. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I CRS. The time is 9:30 a.m. The date is December 16, 2015. We are meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Room, 1700 Broadway, Suite 200, Denver, Colorado. The Title Setting Board today consists of myself, Suzanne Steyer, Deputy Secretary of State, on behalf of Colorado Secretary of State Wayne Williams, Fred Yarger, Solicitor General, designee of Attorney General Cynthia Kaufman, and Sharon Eubanks, Deputy Director of Office of Legislative Legal Services, designee of the Director of Office of Legislative Legal Services, Dan Carton. Today we are meeting to consider title setting for 8 proposed measures. There are 2 titles for each measure. One is a statement and the other is a statement in the form of a question. Changes adopted by the title board in the first title in the staff draft will be considered adopted for the other title. For anyone who wishes to testify, there is a sign-up sheet on the back table. This hearing is broadcast over the internet from the Secretary of State's website, and public restrooms are located on this floor. When the title board considers a proposed initiative for the first time, the board will follow 3 steps. First, board members may wish to ask questions of the proponents. This is to ensure that the board understands the proposal. Second, the board will determine if it has jurisdiction to set a title. In particular, the board must determine if the measure complies with the single subject rule prescribed in Article 5, Section 1, 5.5 of the Colorado Constitution and Section 1-40-106.5 Colorado Revised Statutes. This is because the board is prohibited from setting a title for a measure that contains more than one subject. Third, if the board determines that it has jurisdiction to get a title, to set a title, then the board will use a staff prepared draft for discussion purposes. A copy of the staff draft is on the table. Generally, we will take all testimony first. Then the board will discuss and vote after all testimony has been completed. A decision is reached by 2 of 3 members of the board. Please take note that we are not concerned with the merits of any proposal here. We are only concerned with the setting of titles. Furthermore, we are not concerned with legal or constitutional objections to the measures, except to the extent that such objections relate to the jurisdiction of the board to set titles or to the correctness of the title and summary themselves. Anyone who is dissatisfied with the decision of the title board may file a motion for rehearing with the Secretary of State within 7 calendar days. In the interest of brevity, speakers may incorporate remarks made on the record in prior hearings on similar measures. We have several items on the agenda today, and I'm told that all of the representatives on congressional and legislative redistricting are in the room, which is 2015-2016, number 38. I know that wasn't the first item on the agenda, but I think we're going to take them out of order to accommodate the weather and schedules. So if those proponents could come forward. And if you could please state, is the mic on, Steve?
Yes.
Up there. If you could please state your names for the record.
Scott Cadiz.
Jason Legg.
And if you could start out, why don't you tell us a little about your proposal and in particular what you believe the single subject is.
We view the single subject as reforming the manner in which congressional redistricting is conducted in the state. Did that come across okay?
Yeah, that was fine. And your measure prescribes essentially a new formula to pick the redistricting commission?
New aspects of the formula, I'd say. That's correct.
Okay.
So there's an independent commission that will handle the redistricting process in the future. It's similar to the reapportioned commission, although it's retitled redistricting commission. There's existing criteria now that guides the courts in reviewing how redistricting is conducted. Those same criteria, for the most part, are included in the initiative language. There's a couple new criteria, bands of consideration of political intent and the redistricting process, and also negative impacts on the representation of racial and language minorities.
Are there questions by the board?
I do have a couple of questions. In terms of in general, your measure used the terminology appointment of the members to the commission. There is one place where it talks about, and it's in 1B, it's talking about the legislative, the members of the commission that are, I don't know, the terminology is designate, mm-hmm. whereas the language throughout the measure otherwise is appointment. And I'm just wondering what the significance of that different terminology is.
I'd say that's an insignificant difference. There's no distinction there.
That they're considered appointees just as the other commission members?
Yes.
Okay. And then in terms of the criteria that the commission's supposed to use for both the legislative and congressional districts, can you tell me, are those the existing criteria that's used for either of those categories, or are these new and different, and so it's applying new standards perhaps to the legislative districts or to the congressional districts?
We believe that two of them are novel. If we go to the criteria, it's 2C and 2D. Excuse me, 2C, beginning with 2C. That creates the guideline that districts should not be drawn with the intent to favor or disfavor a political party or incumbent, and also that they should not be drawn with the intent or result of denying or abridging the equal opportunity of racial or language minorities. That's a novel consideration.
And those are novel for both the legislative as well as the congressional districts?
It is. At least in that specific language. There's other overlap as far as categories of considerations, I think, but as far as the specific language, that's new.
So in terms of your belief that your single subject is really dealing with congressional redistricting, because there's new requirements or these new criteria being imposed on both legislative and congressional, perhaps the single subject is broader than just congressional?
Perhaps, yeah. I think it'd probably be more accurate to say it's redistricting reform is the subject, the single subject.
Okay, thank you.
Do you have anything, Fred?
I don't have any questions.
Is there anyone here who wishes to testify on the single subject of this petition? Discussion by the board or a motion?
I believe that there's a single subject. I'm willing to make the motion if the other
I
board
I second
members
that.
Would. Okay, so I would move that we find that proposed initiative number 38 contains a single subject and that we proceed to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Right,
that passes unanimously, which then takes us to title setting. Do you have any comments on the staff draft?
Yeah, we have a few comments. Just in terms of, I got it. My fault. In terms of just some language issues, we were hoping that instead of Colorado Reapportionment Commission, it'd be renamed as Colorado Redistricting Commission. That was how we had it laid out in the initiative. In addition to that, there's a few other language issues that we took issue with. When it discusses whether the initiative requiring the commission members to act in an impartial manner, we were looking for it to state that it was requiring commission members to act in a politically impartial manner. And then because of some of the criteria that we laid out, we further wanted to lay out the prohibition on commission members' actions. Instead of actions, there would be prohibition on commission members' involvement in politics after the service on the commission.
It's really before and after, isn't it?
It is.
That's
I
right.
mean, well, yeah. We don't prohibit, the initiative doesn't prohibit what people do beforehand. It's just a criteria that disqualifies a person. But.
Well, you can't be an elected official, right? Or
yeah, for several years prior to being appointed to the commission.
Right.
And just the changes we think are kind of ways of making the intent and the effect of the initiative more clear. And they're a brief, succinct way to do it as well, just, you know, the addition of one word here or there. So to kind of clarify to the public in what way the commission would be impartial and what types of actions would be proscribed.
And it's not just elected. You can't... You can't be employed by, is that right?
That's right, and that's why we think, I think the language Scott used was commission members' involvement in politics, and it would be before or after. We think that's kind of enough of an umbrella to convey that intent.
Is the prohibition against being a lobbyist? I mean, that's not necessarily a political position. They perhaps participate in the government system, which is at its basis, you know, has partisan politics, but I mean, that's not really a political job, is it?
That's true. I guess reasonable people could disagree on whether or not involvement in politics extends to just people involved in political office or political position or staff for those people, or if it extends to activity like lobbying, where, like, I think, and Scott would believe that that's involvement in politics. That's how we would read it, but perhaps others wouldn't see it the same way, so maybe we need to think harder about the exact way to do that. But regardless, what we're getting at is we would like to have it narrowed somewhat or somewhat defined for the public so they know what actions we're talking about.
Yeah, I agree. It needs to be defined. I'm just not sure if it needs to be narrowed or broadened, because I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily wrap in lower level staff positions in an office as being political in nature.
Okay. Does the board have any suggestions perhaps on that? I know it's kind of asking
to
think on your feet.
We'll start drafting.
Okay.
Do you have anything for the
Was the main comment I had, is that I did think that it needed to be better explained what the limits were on post-commission conduct of members. Do you think that it's a significant change that rather than having certain legislative officers being ex officio members of the commission, that they're now appointees? Do you think that needs to be spelled out in the title? That's the one significant change in how the commission is constituted that you've laid out in your initiative.
I don't know if I think that's significant for the title. I'm open to it. Significant enough to be included in the title if that's necessary. As far as the general intent, the use of an independent redistricting commission, if we've got that, or if we've got independent, you know, Colorado redistricting commission, and subsequently there's language in there talking about the manner in which they're impartial, we think that that'll get across the same message to be consistent with the intent. I guess I want to circle back to that too. Scott had made two comments, and one was on the type of actions, specifying that, and the second was using before in an impartial manner, perhaps inserting in a
politically impartial.
In a politically impartial manner. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that addition.
I mean, I think you're getting more to a partisan impartial manner, not political, which is a little different, but
we debated that as far as what term would a layperson would better understand. If we said nonpartisan manner or apolitical manner, is that too, is that not enough of a general term for the public to know?
My concern is your initiative doesn't say politically impartial. It says in a manner that is impartial and reinforces public confidence in the integrity of the redistricting process.
So yeah, I think we'd be drawing off the language in 2C, which is districts shall not be drawn with the intent to favor or disfavor a political party or incumbent, as further kind of defining the manner in which commission members should act.
Isn't it possible, though, to be impartial and not necessarily be about redrawing districts to favor one party or the other? I mean, there's other aspects of being impartial that I don't know necessarily relates just to whether it favors one party or the other. And the fact that the statement about being impartial has no limitation, I don't know that I'm necessarily comfortable inserting limiting language there.
Yeah, I'm not even all that wrapped up in whether we even say the commission members are required to act in a certain way. I don't know that that really has any meaning until you attach it to what the standards are. And once you start applying standards, you... So I don't know. Why don't we just get started? And...
Okay.
Sharon, what do you have to kick us off? I see notes there.
Well, I think I'm fine with the statement of single subject. And so unless one of you have concerns there, I'd move on to the rest of the title if you were ready.
I was just going to get rid of as well as, maybe just say and.
Well, the first thing I might do is regarding the name change.
Yeah.
To before we get before the phrase directing on that starts on line two, perhaps we want to insert renaming the Colorado Reapportionment Commission as the Colorado Redistricting Commission. Semicolon.
My farsighted vision. I'm looking at that one. I didn't see.
Just so that folks have some notice that,
right,
it is being renamed. And then I think later on, like in the next phrase, then we can just refer to the commission without going through. No, I think I would just take out Colorado reapportionment so that it's just the commission.
My only concern is that it's more than a renaming. It is a renaming, but it's also an expansion of duties. But maybe that's captured later.
Yeah, I mean, the single subject still remains redistricting.
Right.
And then we'll just go into what it's...
Right. I think then you start getting into it in that second phrase where Stephen has the cursor right now in terms of that they deal with congressional as well as legislative redistricting. And so I think just in terms of the name change, I would propose the language on lines 2 and 3 as it appears on the screen.
I agree with that change.
No, expanded.
So I would move it.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right.
And then whether you have...
Well, go ahead. I'm sure you...
Well, I guess
I would imagine you took out as well as... or change the whole thing.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I think there's some purpose to as well as in terms of indicating that they already do legislative districts. But, I mean, that, if you just say and, I mean, that is an accurate statement. I think that as well as was probably some sort of indicator that they already do the one so that... Or you could say...
In addition to... I mean, if you want to do that, I would... Yeah. I mean, if you think it's
directing
important.
The commission, and I think there should be a two after... Between commission and redistrict on line 3. Directing that the commission... Oh, no, you're right. Directing that the commission redistrict congressional districts in addition to state legislative districts. Whether you would find that. I think that's it's trying to give a sense that the commission already had some functions and now it's being added to. But rather than just say and, it makes it sound
right. Okay.
Like both things perhaps are new responsibilities.
That's fine. Yeah.
Then I would move the changes on lines 3 and 4 as shown on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
And then the next point, I think in terms of the point that Fred asked the question about whether it's important to somehow indicate that all of the commission members are now appointed, I think that is a change.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not you just say something like requiring the appointment of all commission members, or I'm open to suggestions there.
I would say requiring that all commission members be appointed.
Okay.
I
so I would move that change.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Now we're back to
impartial.
Yeah, to the impartial. And I'm, at least, just for me, I'm not comfortable adding to that.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to leave,
based on the language of the measure.
If we're going to leave it, I think we leave it. If we're going to leave it in, I think we leave it as it is.
Right.
I agree with you, Suzanne, that the more pertinent aspect of this initiative is that it sets forth standards or criteria which are to be followed by the commission, and that impartiality flows from that. But I don't have objection to leaving it in. I don't know if we achieve much by adding to it.
Yeah, I mean, my problem with it is the action of being impartial is in the application of the standards. I mean, I don't know what it means to act in an impartial manner.
Well, in my reading, you act impartially by following the standards.
Right. So, I mean, applying standards in an I don't know. It's just a kind of strange phrase.
Yeah, if we could interject, we follow your line of thought on that with leaving it as impartial for the reasons you explained. Maybe looking at the concern we were voicing, and we know that there's an interest in brevity as well as getting across a clear message of what the initiative is doing, but maybe an itemization of the criteria themselves would be a way of us in capturing that. It'd obviously add to length, but that way we don't have to try to define impartial, but we still get across the manner in which that's happening.
Is that within the scope of the court's review? Would the Supreme Court be able to overturn a redistricting and apportionment plan based on the partiality or impartiality of the commission's work?
That gets to your earlier point. So I don't think that impartiality is part of the guidelines, but rather we're saying that it's impartial because of the guidelines. The guidelines is what makes it impartial.
Well, how about apply something like redistricting standards in an impartial manner? I just don't know about act in an impartial manner. That just seems, is that directly from this act?
Mm-hmm. No. I think we use it somewhere.
I do think we use that word that we're now making an issue with at some point prior to the guidelines, actually.
You use the word act in an impartial? Okay. Then maybe we should just leave it.
Well, or like you say, take it out here and then put more details in terms of the criteria or something.
I'm okay leaving the language as is. I don't know if it needs to be added to. I don't think it does, is my point.
Okay.
All right. Let's just move to
you could say instead of act, it does say shall apply this section in a manner that is impartial. You could say perform their duties in an impartial manner, but I think act encompasses that and it's briefer. So I think leaving it as is fine.
All right, then to the next line, establishing additional qualifications for commission members.
I would suggest something like establishing additional qualifications for commission members and creating prohibitions on commission members holding certain government positions and positions within political parties before and after service on the commission. not married to that language, but hopefully that gets us started.
I don't know that it covers the lobbying
aspect. And it doesn't cover the lobbying aspect of it.
That's the drawing. You start getting into...
Or paid consultant, too.
And I don't know. It's the participation within political parties. Is that just the qualification part before they serve on the commission, or is there also a limitation after they've served on the commission in terms of being active in a political party?
Not as for party affiliation.
Okay.
After, no.
Okay, so they could be a party official after the fact? I know that's a limitation in terms of a qualification to be appointed to the commission, correct?
Yes.
But not after?
No, it's just okay. Public office afterwards.
So it's sort of the public office, the lobbying, and also in terms of being staff to an elected official?
That's correct.
Okay.
Well, maybe we should divide up the before and after.
We should. I was thinking that. I think if we do that, we end up having three or four phrases when having an inclusive phrase but not explaining exactly which ones are before and after might be sufficient.
Yeah.
One thing you could do is, instead of government positions, holding certain government and government-related positions, because I think that encapsulates contractors, comma, lobbying. Positions and positions with political parties before and after service on the commission. So maybe we ought to start with that. Do you believe that it is accurate and adequate to sort of lump those together as opposed to enumerating each of the three sort of temporal categories that are laid out in the initiative? I'm comfortable lumping them together because I think the idea of a title is to have folks understand basically what's going on and then read the initiative to see exactly how it works. But I can also see the argument that you want to enumerate each category.
I would prefer briefer than sort of the entire delineation of the categories, whether or not you could say something about sort of creating prohibitions on commission members' ability or holding elected or other government-related positions and then drop the rest. Because in terms of the lobbying relates to government.
That's true.
A paid consultant to either Congress or the legislature or a legislator or the elected office. And so whether or not we could at least try to consolidate it down to that statement?
I like that.
You think that gets to the political parties?
I was going to say I don't necessarily think that parties are government. They're built to.
They're elected, I guess.
They are.
But
so is a board of directors.
As I understand it, the limitation on being active as a political party official goes to qualifications. It's not after they've served. If I
we're
understood.
Doing. Oh, after service, okay.
I view the language that we're working on, the proposed language on line 7, just going to the prohibitions.
Okay.
Rather than going to both qualifications and prohibitions.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
But perhaps I'm mis...
I see. So within the phrase, or the, I don't know if it's a phrase or a passage, establishing additional qualifications captures the requirement that you can't have been an elected official or party official before.
To be appointed.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, so to me, a qualification is something different than...
A prohibition.
After the service on the commission. So whether that's correct or not, but that's the way I would view it.
Well, then we'd have to get rid of before. Oh, go ahead, Suzanne.
I'm just saying, I agree, but that's not really what this says. This lumps before and after together.
Right, we'd have to delete, I think, before. And then be comfortable with establishing additional qualifications referring to status as elected positions in political party officers. Which I think I'm comfortable with.
Right, because see, in terms of the restrictions on qualifications, it only applies in terms of being an elected official or being an elected political party officer. So you don't have the lobbyist, you don't have the consultant, you don't have the
right
staffer options. And so that's why I was, I mean, and whether or not, unless you think that that's important, I mean, we could break it into two phrases. You could say establishing additional qualifications for commission members, semicolon.
Yeah.
And then creating prohibitions with more details. Or if you want details in both, we can try to, but they're different details.
Right. I think it's fine the way it is, lumping before and after together, and then people can go read the actual. I mean, the truth is this is going to matter a lot more to somebody seeking an appointment than it is to probably the general electorate.
It's
just going to understand that before and after you can't have certain, do certain things.
Right. Although I do think the prohibition might have implications for example, eligibility to be on a ballot. So separating them maybe does some work. So I'm okay establishing additional qualifications for commission members, semicolon, creating prohibition non-commission members, holding elected or other government-related positions before and after after service on the commission, semicolon.
Before and.
Yeah.
I would just say that if you do that and you make it two separate clauses with a semicolon, then you have descriptors as to the prohibitions, but not as to the additional qualifications. And that's why I like it as one clause as it is now, so that you can read from this that both the qualifications and the prohibitions relate to holding elected or other government-related positions. And you know, the average voter might miss that, but I think that is the import of a semicolon there and separating it from a clause is you don't know what those additional qualifications relate to.
Yeah, but even as written, so I think if that's your preference and the other members of the board agree, the clause as constructed creates a distinction between qualifications and prohibitions. So, and the only qualifications
are for elected offices.
Right, listed are those pertaining to elected office and being a member of a or being an officer within a political party. So I suppose what we could do is say establishing additional qualifications and prohibition. Well, that starts to get difficult, I think.
Yeah.
Although you could make the argument that really in terms of saying that certain individuals are ineligible to be appointed to the commission isn't really a qualification. It's more of a prohibition also. Whether or not we could rework it to actually drop the statement about establishing additional qualifications.
Right.
And just go with sort of the direction we had been going in terms of just creating prohibitions on sort of people that can serve on the commission and then on commission members after service on the commission, whether that would be better.
Well, let me put it this way. I think describing all of those as prohibitions makes sense to me.
So I'm comfortable with that.
Okay, so if we go ahead and strike the phrase "where your cursor is now" on lines 5 and 6 through the semicolon.
I like that. My only, I'm comfortable with government-related encompassing contractors and lobbyists. I don't think I'm comfortable using the term elected to refer to both public officers in government and party officers within political parties.
I agree about the party officers. That's not...
So government. What if we move this change and then work on that aspect of it?
Well, are you saying we're going to have one phrase for both before and after?
Yes. Okay. So before and maybe needs to go back in.
All right.
Drafting by committee.
Holding elected political or...
It's before and after service in the commission.
I mean, in a way, I mean, you might be able to distinguish it from elected public office versus elected
political,
political party.
Yeah.
And it's only state political parties.
County.
It's not, what's that?
County, I think.
Oh, shall not have been an elected... okay. District, county, or state political party officer. Mm-hmm. Elected official and... Okay.
So maybe holding elected office, comma, political party, and officer.
Office in a political party.
Yeah, there.
Creating prohibitions. I'm comfortable with that.
Yeah, I am too, and then we get them both together. Save a phrase.
Do the proponents have any comments on the red line? It just looked like you were discussing amongst yourselves. I want to make sure we addressed anything.
We know the answer, but was it the board's position that other government-related positions catches lobbying and lobbyists?
Consultants, lobbying, and employees.
That was our intent.
I mean, the fact that... I mean, the lobbyists are participating in government process, more than likely. But they aren't. I mean, they relate, those positions relate to government. I don't think that government-related means that they're just government employees or contractors. So I think that government-related, that because they're participating in the government process, the political process, the legislative process, I think I'm comfortable with the terminology.
I am too.
Okay.
And I think, I am too. Just leave it at that.
So you want to move your language?
Sure. I move the language as reflected on lines, currently on lines 5 through 8 of the draft.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. That takes us to the next clause about the criteria.
And we were just going to mention with the new criteria, since technically they're both new criteria, we were going to suggest possibly including what that criteria is relating to racial and language minorities, listing that out there to further explain what that new criteria is.
It's that and something else, though, isn't it? It's that and...
Just some kind of similar language or effort as the board's making towards describing the prohibitions to be done with the criteria as well. We would support that.
And I just wonder, do you think that it's meaningful to most voters to have the details of, I mean, because, you know, redistricting in general is not something that most people are familiar with or understand. And so whether or not you think it's really important to include details about the criteria in the title, whether that will really help most folks make a decision.
We'd agree that not most voters aren't intimately familiar with redistricting, but if they are, the one aspect of it they're probably familiar with is the use of the term gerrymandering, which gets to the criteria that guides the redistricting process. And so we do think it's salient and important.
I mean, my problem with it is that they're not going to know the original standards. So to call out new standards without laying out the other standards.
And that's why, and that makes sense to us, listing perhaps all the standards or trying to get the same kind of inclusive language you had.
I don't think I'm going to be advocating listing all the standards out.
Let's annotate it.
I don't necessarily, and maybe I'm in the minority here, but I don't think it's necessarily problematic to state that new criteria are established. Those voters that are interested in the subject and care to know, like with all of the initiatives we see, would have to do a little bit more reading and understand what the old standards were and what the new standards are and form their own opinions about whether they agree or disagree with them.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that certainly would go in the blue book, but to put it in the question seems like it's going to, we're either going to have to really get into the weeds.
So you don't think we should mention new standards?
I think we should mention that they exist. I'm not sure we should mention what they are.
I agree with that. But I
think they're saying they want us to say what they are.
I see. I'm just focused on whether or not we mention that there are new criteria.
I think we have to say there's new criteria.
Oh, okay.
I agree.
Okay, good. Then I'm glad I consumed some time over
that's
non-controversial topic.
I do have another question in terms of okay, so we know that there's new criteria and perhaps some existing criteria. In terms of the order of criteria, or what I would view as the prioritization of the criteria as applied, the prioritization applies to all the criteria, both the new and whatever existing criteria. And I'm no expert on redistricting criteria, so I'm just lumping it together that whether it's important to distinguish sort of new criteria versus the prioritization of all of the criteria applied to be applied by the commission, and whether that's just a nuance to me because I'm not as familiar with redistricting as other folks may be, but whether that might be, rather than just clarifying the order of criteria.
Maybe reprioritizing.
Make it clear that it's all the criteria rather, because I don't want people to think it's just the new criteria.
Right.
So whether we say something along the line of establishing new criteria and prioritizing all of the criteria.
Mm.
Is there a need to use the word new, even? Since this is a novel district for congressional redistricting, all of the criteria are new with the existing reapportionment commission, some overlap, and then with how congressional redistricting has been done in the past, there are existing criteria that the courts have looked at and the legislature's put out there. But as far as through this structure, I think all of the criteria are new, and the priority that they're provided in are new, and maybe just saying establishing criteria and clarifying their priority would suffice. Because just as you said, I don't think that the voters are going to know that there's what the existing criteria are to know that there's new ones. They'd have to look into that, as you said. And the same goes for the existing prioritization and what it is going forward.
Is all of the criteria in your measure new for the legislative redistricting?
Not all of it, but all of it is new criteria for the redistricting commission.
Yeah, but I think they have to know that what exists in law now is, I'd like to call out that there's something new in there.
Well, establishing criteria connotes
that it's new.
That it's new.
Okay. Whether or not you could say establishing and prioritizing criteria that the commission,
yeah,
and I think, you know, whether it should be is to apply rather than shall, but
it just, yeah, I like that.
Establishing and prioritizing.
I would say establishing and prioritizing the criteria the commission will apply in redrawing districts.
That sounds good to me.
I move lines 7 through 9, the changes on lines 7 through 9 as currently reflected on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. Proponents have any other comments before I read it into the record?
I think we discussed this in detail already, but and it's been decided upon. But as far as the some kind of summary or description of the criteria themselves, it's not, there's more of them. They're probably more difficult to summarize. But just as with the prohibitions, kind of having a brief description that you guys have added there, for the same reasons we think that it would be helpful to have, if you can come up with a brief description of the criteria, we think that that would be helpful and would support it, but obviously you've discussed and considered already.
Well, if you want to bring back some suggested language at the rehearing, feel free.
Okay.
I'm not sure I really want to.
And while I know that you described sort of the intent of the criteria is to prevent gerrymandering, you know, you don't, we just can't use that term. Yeah. I mean, first of all, to me, it's not apparent. I mean, that may be what all these different criteria do, but the criteria is much more difficult to describe, and I think that's probably better left to the Blue Book explanation in terms of the details.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and read it. An amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning redistricting in Colorado and in connection therewith, renaming the Colorado Reapportionment Commission as the Colorado Redistricting Commission, directing that the commission redistrict congressional districts in addition to state legislative districts, requiring that all commission members be appointed, requiring commission members to act in an impartial manner, creating prohibitions on commission members holding elected office, office in a political party, or other government-related positions before and after service on the commission, and establishing and prioritizing the criteria the commission will apply in redrawing districts.
Good. Okay, I would move the language as it appears on the screen for number 38.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. That takes us to, are we going to go back on the agenda, Steve, or where are we going?
If counsel for the objectors on 51 and 52 is present, then we should move on to the rehearings for 51 and 52.
All right. And we're going to take up initiative 2015-2016, number 51, food store license. Hmm. And we have Mr. Rogers for the proponents. If you could just introduce yourself and state their names.
Hi, Trey Rogers for the proponents, Blake Harrison and Grayson Robinson, who are both here. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And we have a motion for rehearing filed. If the petitioner could come forward on the rehearing.
Good morning.
Just state your name.
My name is Megan Downing. Together with Mark Gruskin, we represent the objectors, James Dean and Gene McAvoy.
Okay. And can you please go ahead and state your reasons for your motion for rehearing?
Yes, what we did in this case was we actually filed a written pleading laying out the various objections and the legal grounds and argument in support. And I know we worked to make it a pretty thorough but as concise as possible pleading. And just to be economical with your time, I don't want to simply restate everything. If the board is comfortable, I can simply rest on our written record.
Is there anything you want to add to it?
No, thank you.
So questions by the board then? You didn't bring any suggested language, did you?
No.
You just filed like that.
Can we go ahead and start?
Sure, unless you want me to
call
Mr. Rogers
I don't have any questions right now. But,
oh, okay. All right, then why don't we let Mr. Rogers respond to the petition, and then we'll...
Okay.
I think that'd be helpful.
Okay. And if it's all right, our preference would be to handle these objections one at a time.
Sure.
And allow the board to deal with them and then move on to the next one. So we would start with the objection to the use of the terms full-strength beer and wine in the title, and the argument that that's made by the objectors, that that's a catchphrase. It is simply not. The kinds of terms that have been held by the Supreme Court to be a catchphrase are words like a proposal that would be enacted, quote, as rapidly and effectively as possible. Another is that a particular initiative was a, quote, declaration of the people. These are words that have a certain emotional appeal, but that convey no helpful information to the voter. And in fact, that may mislead or confuse the voter. The Supreme Court case law is pretty clear on that. Here we are dealing.
Can I just interrupt and get to the heart of it? I read the cases cited here. One of them was difficult to find because it was miscited. But there are slogans like, quote, freedom to work,
yes,
which was in the 1982 case.
Yes.
And then phrases like open government and consumer protection.
Yes.
Explain how full-strength beer and wine are different from those, and particularly open government and consumer protection, because those are terms that are currently found in statute.
Yeah, open government is perhaps an aspirational goal, right? What does open government mean? I mean, it's much as you were struggling with what does impartial mean in the hearing on the last measure. Full-strength beer and wine are merely descriptive. By the way, I'll point out the objector said, you know, this is a catchphrase or these are words that we made up. You know, in fact, they're the same words that your staff came up with to describe what Venice and malt liquors mean. We didn't write that staff draft; your staff did, and they said Venice liquors and malt liquors, commonly known as full strength beer and wine. This is just common parlance, and it's completely consistent with your obligation, title board's obligation, to set a title that, according to the Supreme Court, quote, uses terms in the common understanding of most voters. We would submit that Venice liquors and malt liquors are simply not terms that would be understood by the typical voter. Full-strength beer and wine are. Let me cut to one very important point here. We and the proponents in drafting this measure used the terms currently found in Article 47. Now, when we did that, we understood that that was good practice, it was good drafting, it was going to make Ledge Council happy and OLLS happy. We also understood that there was a risk that someone would come in and rehearing and say, oh, no, you can't refer to these as full-strength beer and wine. You have to refer to them as Venice liquors and malt liquors. Well, if that's the rule, then what is to stop a proponent from departing completely from the language of existing statute? It would be poor drafting. It would create a nightmare in terms of interpretation. We certainly could have drafted this thing to say, food stores are permitted to sell beer. Beer is defined as follows. They are permitted to sell wine. Wine is defined as follows. We didn't do that. We did the right thing. We used the terms of the statute. We shouldn't be punished for it. The voters shouldn't be punished for it by having to parse through archaic terms.
Do you know if in these other cases, terms like freedom to work, open government, and consumer protection were defined later in the title or in the initiative?
I don't know if in those particular cases
Do you think it makes a difference that the title defines the term full-strength beer and wine?
I think it absolutely makes a difference, yes. I think there is no chance for voter confusion. I don't think there's any voter emotional response. And I do think these are terms that convey something understandable and important information about the measure to the voter.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the words have any emotional reaction. I mean, some people are going to be in favor of full strength, and some people are going to be opposed to full strength. You know, we're using a word like open government. You can't really find a lot of people who are opposed to open government. So it's kind of a catchphrase, freedom, you know, the same way. It just is an emotional word that maybe doesn't really mean that much, just like open government doesn't really mean anything by itself. Full strength beer and wine means something that is not emotive in my mind. So some people might like it a lot, but that doesn't mean, I mean, if you described it as vine, you know, something else, it's just the same thing. The person may enjoy those beverages, but
as I understand the criteria in the case law, there are two. One, does the phrase, quote, color the merit of the proposal? And two, can the phrase serve as the basis for a slogan? I think the two have to be considered together because I think almost anything could be the basis for a slogan, and most certainly full-strength beer and wine is the basis for a slogan. So I think the standard that we're directed to apply here, if I understand the case law, is whether or not this colors the merits of the proposal. I agree. I don't know that it does. I wonder if, and I know we debated this before, does it respond to the objection to remove that from the sort of title clause and move it down? We debated that at the last hearing and decided that it wouldn't do any good because the whole point is to use a commonly understood term and then define it later.
And I think the common use of it outweighs, you know, whether it could be used in a slogan. I mean, the slogan really here is conveniently buy full strength beer and wine. I mean, I suppose if we put something in there about how convenient it was going to make it. But I mean, in the advertising, that's really the sort of sell, the emotional sell is that it'll be easier to obtain, more convenient to obtain. You don't have to go make a separate trip. I'm not sure the use of the term beer and wine, I would very hesitant to get rid of those two terms. I mean, if we were going to get rid of a term, I suppose it would be full strength. But to get rid of beer and wine is to just add confusion to the measure. I mean, those are the two words that have the common understanding.
I agree.
And just so you know, and I know we discussed this at the original setting of the title, I had some concern about using those terms, full strength beer and wine, especially in the single subject, and I think I'm even more convinced now that that is a problem. I thought it was very interesting in terms of the table wine case the initiative in that case actually defined table wine because it had a lower maximum alcohol content. And the title did not use the term table wine. It actually talked about wine containing not more than 14% of alcohol by volume in sealed containers, not to be consumed on the premises. I mean, it went that direction. So the full-strength beer and wine does not have a basis in law. I think that it should be in the single subject, say malt and vinous liquors, and then as we might be able to describe that later in the title. But I think right now that I would change the language. I do think that it's a catchphrase. I don't think there's any basis in the law for that description, and that it can be a catchphrase.
So would you be comfortable saying in a change of the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning the sale of malt and vinous liquors, and in connection therewith, creating a license allowing food stores to sell malt and vinous liquors commonly referred to as full-strength beer and wine, or would you excise it from the entire title?
I would not include those references at all, but I do have an alternative to help explain what those terms mean, but not using those specific terms. And I'm happy to tell you what those would be, more based on what the statute defines those to be, which includes specifically malt liquors, which includes beer that contains certain alcohol content, spell that out, and the vinous liquors, which includes wine that contains no more than a certain alcohol content by weight. So you have the references to beer and wine, which exist in the law, also have the alcohol content, because there is no basis for full strength.
Do you share my understanding of the law being these two criteria, color the proposal and then form the basis of a slogan to be criteria that must be both applied, or are they separate? If they violate either, are they problematic?
Go ahead.
It's got to be both. If it's not both, then there is no common language description of any initiative that wouldn't be a catchphrase.
And I think I agree with that in terms of that it's got to be both.
So do you think that this colors the proposal?
I do, in the sense that it's a type of beer that some people prefer over 3-2. And so this is telling them that if you're really interested in this kind of beer, now you're going to be able to get it at food stores.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
Well, Fred, it's really on you, because I personally prefer the current description and the fact that they may or may not use it in a slogan. I mean, they could have just used beer and wine and not used full strength. I think grocery stores don't really sell a lot of wine. They might have a couple bottles. I don't even know. I haven't bought one.
Cooking wine? I don't know. Other than those,
can't
have
alcohol.
Pharmacy.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they were going to use beer and wine, whether they used full strength. To me, it's almost curious they used that in the slogan. And the fact that they did, I don't think should color our determination.
I agree.
You want to use beer and wine, or you want to go with Sharon's language?
I think I am comfortable overruling the objection, so sticking with the language we used.
Okay. In the title, or?
In the title.
Okay. All right. What's your next?
So the next argument is that the term food store is misleading. As you know, the language the board adopts must be brief, unambiguous, and direct, according to the case law, and should reference only the central points of a measure. Board isn't required to include every aspect of a proposed measure in the title. Here, the average voter understands a food store to mean a place where he or she can buy food. Whether the place sells 20, 25, or 40%, whether 20, 25, or 40% of its sales are food is really irrelevant. The point is, it's a place where you can buy food. And the 25% number is simply not a central feature of the initiative. Its inclusion would make the title longer and unnecessarily complicated.
Well, I don't think it would make it longer. We say a specified percentage. We could say at least 25%.
I'm fine.
And I know I'm the one that suggested perhaps taking that detail out, that it was actually in both the staff draft as well as Mr. Rogers' revised draft that he offered to the title board at the initial hearing. I do think that in terms of, and it was very interesting because in the table wine case, they also had a requirement, it was at least 50%. So I do think that that might be helpful in understanding the types of stores that it, if 25% versus 50% versus 75% to have that percentage back in so that to change it from a specified percentage to at least 25% as it, we originally considered at our last meeting.
My view is that either is an acceptable title. So I don't, if you believe that adds clarity, I would defer, but I believe both are acceptable.
I mean, for some folks that they may not know how much, and I don't know that I would necessarily know how much a regular convenience store sells in terms of food items versus other types of items. But I do think that the number in terms of, you know, whether it's majority, less than majority, similar to on the table wine case, I think that might be helpful information in terms of getting across the idea that it may be more common to be in stores that you wouldn't normally think of just as full-scale grocery stores.
Are you comfortable with that?
I'm fine with that.
Yep.
So I would move the change on lines 4 and 5.
Second.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Passes unanimously.
All right.
And counsel for the petitioner, if you have anything you want to, I don't know where you went, but if you have anything you want to add, please feel free to just stand up and, you know, let us know your thoughts.
Okay. The next objection is to the omission of the grandfathering of existing 3-2 license holders from the distance from schools provision of law. Frankly, I don't think as I read the motion that the objectors understood that this is merely a grandfathering for existing 3-2 license holders. It is not an exemption for any new license holder. The fact that it is merely for existing license holders, I believe, makes it more of a detail, less of a central feature of the measure. And the fact that we currently have those 3-2 vendors, sellers of alcohol, within 500 feet of a school, makes this not necessarily a change. I mean, this is we have created a new license, which is in a gray area between 3-2 vendors that don't have a school distance requirement and vendors of all alcohol, including spiritus liquor, what we would commonly refer to as liquor, who do have a distance requirement from the school. So the fact that we fall in between and we just haven't included within the title, or you have not included within the title, how we deal with this new entity and this restriction for purposes of existing entities is simply not a central feature of the measure and need not be included within the title.
Could I ask Ms. Downing a question? In terms of the current terminology of the title, I mean, to me, to say regardless of the proximity to a school means it doesn't matter how close it's located. Is it what you're suggesting is that we use different terminology to describe? I mean, I don't know that I want to get into, you know, that it's less than, even if it's less than 500 feet, but to me, regardless means it doesn't matter how close or how far it is from a school. And so I'm just curious in terms of what change you might be seeking.
I don't know that I'm in a position to accept any specific or propose any specific changes in regarding the objections that we have made. I can say that, as was just stated, it may have been a confused issue that we understood that this would apply to the new licenses. And so that maybe creates a separate inquiry to sort that out in advance, if that makes sense.
So you're saying you might have been confused about the measure?
I might have been confused.
Okay.
Well, but I think the point is that our objection is that this language is misleading and confused. The way it reads now, I read it that the new licensed food stores would be permitted to continue operating regardless of proximity to school, which, as we've stated in the objection, is a significant departure from the liquor code as it has
the language
existed.
You seem to be suggesting is language like setback, buffer, or 500-foot mandate. Isn't proximity to schools sort of a more neutral way to describe those concepts?
I think where I might be addressing a separate issue is that it wasn't necessarily the distance from the school and how to state that. It was that we have this distance requirement in the liquor code as it stands. And as we understood the language, regardless of proximity to school, is that a food store with the new license could be selling full-strength beer and wine at any proximity of a school. So I don't know that changing the specifics with regard to the distance requirement addresses how we perceive the language as misleading, that it would apply to the new licensed food stores.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, and I don't know that I read the measure that way. I thought it was just those that had a 3-2 license that were trying to get the food store license. But if it's the idea of that proximity doesn't, for some folks, may not describe, you know, whether we could reword it to say something regardless of the food store's distance to a school, you know, if that's helpful. But I never understood it to be more than just the 3-2 licensee trying to get a food store license. Those were the only food store licensees that would not be subject to the 500-foot limitation. Is that?
That's correct.
So you, it's not, it's, so under this one, you could still keep your, under this measure, you can still keep your 3-2 license. Correct?
You could.
You can,
well, no, so this wouldn't have an impact on the someone who keeps their 3-2 license.
Right. But you're adding to that people who then apply to become a food store. So what we have as a practical matter is we do have now sales of full-strength beer and wine potentially next to a school.
We do not.
We do not.
You mean under the measure?
Under the measure. Once you get a food store license, you can continue to sell what you, because you were a 3-2 seller before. Right? Mm-hmm. So I'm a 3-2 seller now. I have a King Supers, you know, 30 feet away from a school across the street. I can apply for a food store license, and now I can sell full-strength beer and wine 30 feet across the school street from a school.
Correct.
Okay.
As distinguished from the case in which a new King Supers is built,
right,
or an existing King Supers that doesn't have a 3-2 license,
exactly,
applies for a food store license.
Yeah. So is that your understanding? That's what I think. I think that's where the confusion is, not in the word proximity, but in perhaps the way this is worded, making it sound like we're still only going to sell 3-2 near a school.
I'm so sorry.
Right.
Please go ahead.
That's exactly right. And I think I did a poor job of articulating that because of the confusion in the, I think, the context of the language. So on page 3, near the bottom of our objection, we note, and it's in paragraph 2, the title merely refers to continuing operating regardless of the food store's proximity to a school. This is misleading because it does not inform voters that for food store licenses, the measure eliminates the buffer completely between educational institutions and liquor license facilities. So the point to be made is that that is a significant, I think, central feature and a departure from what voters understand, that there is this distance requirement, and that's going to change. It's more than just 3-2 sellers continuing to operate, but it's under the new license. We understood the language to allow full-strength beer and wine to be sold within any proximity.
I understand. I agree, and what I would suggest we do, if others agree, is rather than say to continue operating, it would be to sell full-strength beer and wine, regardless of the food store's proximity to the school.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah, that might be.
Although I will voice my objection.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, preserving your objection to the use of the phrase full-strength beer and wine.
Right. Sorry.
All right. I think that gets to maybe a little both sides concerned. All right. You want to go to the next one, Mr. Rogers, or do you want to comment on this? Oh, okay, yeah. Let's vote on this one.
So I'll go ahead and move the language on line 7 as it appears on the screen.
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, that passes.
Ready for the next one?
Sure.
So the next 4 objections are to the exclusion of the multiple licenses of food stores that would be permitted under the measure. I'm going to group all 4 of them together. So they are that one. Title fails to state that food store licensees must establish needs and desires or how that would be dealt with, only if local licensing authorities require it. Third, that the measure allegedly sets a presumptive and conclusive test for licensees' reputation, character, and record. It doesn't, but the point is that provision in the initiative has been excluded. And then finally, that the fee has been excluded from the title. And I'd like to just handle all of those together without adding much to what I've already said. Those are all details. None of those are central features of the measure. None of them warrant inclusion in the title. And so we'd like to see them. We'd like to see the petition denied as to those 4 items.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only one we really struggled with last time was maybe D.
Yeah.
Multiple licenses. So, I mean, fees and presumptive test. And I wasn't as concerned about that. Multiple licenses is really what prohibits it now.
If that's the one that's of concern, I'd be happy to dig down on that one a little.
Obviously, I didn't think it was central enough last time, but. I guess I'm just more dispensing with the other 3 that I didn't have a lot of thoughts on, but you know, I could go either way on that one.
And if I could just ask for clarification, I'm looking at the measure. It can be any current licensee under the liquor code. I mean, it doesn't have to be a retail store. I mean, you know, because there's all the categories, and we know, like, the grocery stores that currently sell alcoholic beverages have a pharmacy license. At least that's my understanding. So it's not limited to just retail liquor store licensees having an interest in now a food, a licensed food store. It could be any category of licensee under the liquor code that could have a an interest in a food store.
That's right. And in fact, it's not even an express authorization for multiple ownership. All that we've done here is to say, notwithstanding any provisions of this article to the contrary, you can own more than one of these. So you are correct. It would apply to any current license under Article 47 that contains a restriction. That licensee would be able to own as many food stores as they would like to own. But it certainly does not change anything, doesn't change the single license requirement for those existing licensees other than as to this new license.
Because this was an issue that I raised, I mean, we had a discussion at the initial hearing about, I think it would be easy enough to add some language to put, because it is a change. And maybe more of an issue because you don't have multiple ownership allowed currently under the liquor code. And so this is more of a major change in that regard. Whether or not, you know, how you describe it in terms of, you know, allowing, I don't know that I have good language, you know, a current licensee under the liquor code or something to own one or more licensed food stores. I mean, it's a fairly simple phrase, I think, to get that concept across. If we're so inclined to make that change. I think out of these four objections, I think this one's probably the only one that I might agree that that's a major enough change that it probably should be included.
So I agree with that. I would not be inclined to deal with EF or to grant EF or G. I think it would be helpful for me to hear more from the petitioner on D.
So I think the gravamen for the objection has actually been articulated by the board, which is that ownership of more than one license is new. It's a departure from the current law. So I don't have anything substantive to add to that. I think it's our position is stated in the written motion, and I can reiterate it, but I don't have anything substantive more.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Sure.
I do want to take issue with Ms. Eubank's characterization of this as a change, and let me explain why. I understand it looks like a change. It's really not. We, again, because it's good drafting and I think will result in good law, we included this new license in 47. We could have very easily put it in its own article or somewhere else in statute. If we had done that, we would have omitted this provision, because what current law says, what the retail liquor license section says, is no owner of a license under this section can own any other Article 47 license. That's all we're dealing with. If we had put this off on its own island, then that language would not limit ownership of these licenses in any way. If we had put it in its own article, you could own a retail liquor store or a liquor licensed drugstore, and you could own as many food stores as you want to. So again, you know, we did what we thought was the best thing from a drafting perspective. We put this in what we think is the right place in statute. And because we did that, we had to say, notwithstanding the reference to owning other licenses under this article, you get to own as many food stores as you want. So for that reason, it's not a change, and it's another instance in which If you're going to include this in the title, you know, it begins to create a perverse incentive for us to try to draft around problems that we identify in title setting when we decide how we're going to put a measure together.
So just to clarify, you get to own as many food stores as you want.
Yes.
That sell full-strength beer and wine.
Correct. And as under current law, you can own as many stores that sell 3-2. There's no limit in Article 46 on multiple ownership. The only limitation on multiple ownership is in a few sections of Article 47, retail liquor license, drugstore. There may be others. Those are the two that I'm aware of. We could have put this in 46 and we could have left out this provision. It's just not a change in the law.
But even if you put it in 46, the effect would have been the same, and I'm not sure my opinion would have changed. I mean, you could have created a whole new article, and the issue is, you know, what is changing, not necessarily what black and white is changing on paper, but what is changing in the way, you know, these laws are going to function. And what you're doing is, you know, selling a product that you used to only be able to have one license for and expanding the licenses for that.
Well,
you know, I mean, otherwise you have to equate 3-2 with full strength beer and wine.
There are plenty of licensees under Article 47 that can have multiple licenses. Taverns can have multiple licenses. Restaurants can have multiple licenses. In fact, the majority of the 15 or 20 licensees under Article 47 can have multiple licenses. There just happen to be a couple of particular licenses that have this limitation. And so...
Yeah, I mean, my problem with the history of where that limitation comes from and... I mean, we're seeing the same thing with, you know, marijuana legislation. I mean, the multiple ownership becomes a huge issue from a, you know, historically from a corruption and prohibition. And I just think the concept is a different thing. And again, I'm, you know, I was fine leaving it out last time. It may be just more to me than to the average voter. And I do try to separate my, you know.
You have a little more knowledge than the average voter.
Yeah, I mean, I try to separate, okay, I, you know how a liquor board functions from what maybe the average person cares about. So that's why I'm sort of on the fence. But, you know, from a liquor licensing perspective, from a police enforcement perspective, this is probably a big change for them. That doesn't mean it is one for the public.
My view is that we can add information on this topic without violating our duty to make the title brief. I don't see any harm in including it. So I agree with adding some language that is, and I see somebody working over there, maybe on some draft language that we might be able to work on. So why don't we start that? Maybe there's a suggestion.
Well, if I was more familiar with all the categories of liquor licensees, because as Mr. Rogers indicated, some licensees are not restricted in terms of holding multiple or having multiple locations.
I think it's really only retail.
Is it retail liquor stores?
Retail liquor stores and liquor licensed drug stores are the two that
have,
again,
the limit.
I can't say that those are the only two out of the 15 or 20, but those are the two that... Well, I'll say this. Those are the two that caught the attention at review and comment, and no other kind of sections were called out. So I think those are most likely the only two.
And do you think it would be misleading to include this information in the title?
If you draft it right, I don't think it would be.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, and so I'm just struggling with, since it's not all licensees, whether, you know, whether we get to the sum or certain, which I don't much care for, but at least it indicates there's some that people could look for more information. But allowing certain liquor licensees to own one or more licensed food stores, something along those lines. I mean, because I don't know that we want to get into that it's a retail liquor store or a pharmacy liquor license or...
I think if we limit it to that, I mean, a person that doesn't have a retail liquor license or a drugstore liquor license can also have own multiple licenses. So I think if we're...
But it's a single license under which more than one location can operate.
No, it would be multiple licenses.
It would be multiple licenses, yeah, for each
individual store.
Just that a single person cannot be.
Yeah, it's the person can't hold the license. It can't. Currently, someone who holds a retail liquor store license cannot have another licensed.
Correct.
Liquor store or any other type of. I mean,
Article
they don't,
47 license.
Right. And so now they're allowed to have food store licenses, but not multiple liquor store licenses.
That's right. No change as to multiple liquor store licenses. Right. Right.
I mean, and perhaps voters don't necessarily distinguish liquor that's sold in a pharmacy. Versus any other type of retail liquor store outlet. We could say allowing a person who owns a retail liquor store to own one or more licensed food stores. Whether that ties too much into just the one license, the terminology for the one license, that's a little bit of my, or we could expand it and say who owns a retail or pharmacy liquor store, to own one or more licensed food stores.
I'm not even sure that's true, is it? I think if you have a retail, I think this is to expand people who can hold, to say if you hold a food store license, you can hold more than one. It
would also permit the owner of a retail liquor license or a liquor licensed drugstore to own
a food store.
One or more food store licenses, yes.
Because it's my understanding right now, and I live on the south side, there's this, a certain grocery store that has liquor in it. I assume under a pharmacy license.
Liquor license, drugstore, yes.
Right, and it's a chain grocery store. And so right now, without the language in this measure, it could not have any of its other grocery store locations that qualify as a food store actually licensed as a food store under the liquor code.
Correct.
Okay. So now they can maintain their one pharmacy and then expand to their other grocery stores, food stores.
That's my understanding.
Correct.
Would that be correct?
Yes.
Okay. So to me, it's not that there can be multiple, someone can own multiple licensed food stores. It's more the issue of the crossover between the categories of licenses. So, I guess it's just the question of whether we're specific as to the licenses that we're talking about, or whether we generalize it in terms of allowing a person who owns a retail liquor store to own one or more licensed food stores, if that's sufficient.
Well, if I could, we're kind of guessing here that there are only those two licenses that have the restriction, and I'm nervous that we set a title that would be
I'm relying on your expertise.
Well, I could propose something that I think gets around that problem.
Okay.
How about something along these lines? Permitting the ownership of multiple food store licenses by the owners of liquor licenses.
Or certain.
That's not quite there.
I mean, because we know, based on your comments, we know that there's some liquor licensees that don't have this restriction.
Correct.
And so whether or not we insert certain.
It would help me to get some language on the screen. And I wonder if we just start with the proponent's language and then we can massage it.
All right, so let me.
Permitting the ownership.
I would say permitting the ownership of multiple food store licenses, and then I would amend what I just said to say, including by the owners of certain liquor licenses. Without the including, it suggests that only the owners of certain liquor licenses could own multiple licenses.
Can we just change permitting to allowing?
Yep.
I like allowing better.
I think we need a comma after licenses.
Yeah.
Oh, good, because I was confused.
I mean, I'd even be just fine with allowing the ownership of multiple food store licenses. And then at least that triggers them to go look at, or that there's a change in that law. But I'm fine with this, too.
What do you think about excluding that, the language after the comma?
Well, I'd certainly be fine with that. It doesn't get to the objection that has been raised.
In terms of the cross-category ownership that's currently prohibited
right.
for certain current licensees.
Right.
Well, we could leave it at that.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a little awkward, but I can't think of a different way
of
doing it.
Hey, you know, I'm doing this on the fly here.
Does the movement or petitioner have any comments on that language?
I do not.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So I would move the proposed language that currently appears on lines 8 and 9.
Second.
Please. Sorry, before you do that. A colleague has just suggested that the insertion of the word retail between certain and liquor licenses would be helpful. There are many kinds of liquor licenses, wholesale, importer, manufacturer, and the point here is that the retail a retail liquor license owner could have food store licenses. So sorry to interrupt the motion.
I would withdraw my motion. And now move with the addition of the word retail on line 9, I would now move the proposed language that appears on lines 8 and 9 of the screen.
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. So it passes unanimously. All right.
I think that covers the objections.
All right, let me go ahead and read it in, and then we'll... A change to the Colorado revised statutes concerning the sale of full-strength beer and wine by food stores and in connection therewith creating a license allowing food stores to sell malt and vinous liquors commonly referred to as full-strength beer and wine for off-premises consumption, defining a food store as an establishment that earns at least 25% of its annual gross income from the sale of food, allowing a food store that holds a valid license to sell fermented malt beverages commonly referred to as 3.2 beer to apply to become a food store licensee and, if granted, to sell full-strength beer and wine regardless of the food store's proximity to a school, allowing the ownership of multiple food store licenses, including by owners of certain retail liquor licenses, and prohibiting the sale of full-strength beer and wine by a food store employee who is under 21 years of age.
Okay. So I think that our motion is that we grant the motion for rehearing on initiative number 51 to the extent that this board has taken action and deny it in all other respects.
Second.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to our rehearing on, right, Steve?
52.
Yeah. on 2015-2016 number 52 food store license.
Madam Chair, Trey Rogers on behalf of the proponents who are present today.
Right. Megan Downing again on behalf of the objectors, James Dean and Jean McAvoy, who are not present. And again, the same record. We filed a very similar pleading, noting our objections in writing. It is nearly identical, and I would maintain the same objections as we raised with regard to number 51. Paragraph Roman numeral 1 is the substantively different objection that I would note and rest on the written record.
Well, because we can't give inconsistent titles as a Title IV, one of our mandates, I think I'm not sure we're bound to, but I think it makes sense for us to rule similarly on the similar objections and then maybe treat the single subject objection separately.
But should we be dealing with single subject? Because if we were to find that there isn't a single subject, then we wouldn't
right.
be setting a title at all.
That's right. So I, that's right.
But I agree.
Just
that
setting
if we get,
the agenda.
If we get to that point, we should be able to utilize our decisions on 51 to guide us on 52.
All right. So we'll incorporate the comments on 51 into our discussion on 52 if and when we get there. But let's start with single subject. Mr. Rogers, you want to respond to the filing?
Sure. I don't think that the objection plowed any new ground. We had a pretty wholesome discussion of this issue 2 weeks ago. It remains the proponent's contention that when liberally construed, as required by case law, and I think the Constitution as well, that the subjects of this Measure 52 are necessarily improperly connected to the single subject, which is the permission or the authorization of the sale of full-strength beer and wine in food stores. Moreover, the way in which they are linked is, among other things, there is the possibility of voter confusion if you have the or consumer confusion if you have the same stores selling 3-2 beer on the one hand and full-strength beer on the other hand. I remind the board you can't have two licenses at any location, so it is not the case that there would be a 3-2 license and a full-strength beer and wine license at the same location. And we anticipate that virtually all, if not all, of the 3-2 licensees are going to want to convert. Finally, there is none of the harms or the concerns that the courts have with regard to single subject are implicated here. There's no surprise or fraud on the voters. In fact, the fact that the 3-2 off-premises license would no longer be available is reflected in the title that was set. So this is not a surprise coiled in the folds of the measure. It's not piggybacking, as that term is used by the Supreme Court to suggest a problem or a concern. So we think you got it right the first time, 2 weeks ago, and that there is a single subject for this measure.
I think based on our previous discussion, I'm comfortable with our conclusion that there was a single subject. I would again voice my objection to the terminology as it appears in the single subject, consistent with our discussion on number 51. But in terms of there being a single subject, I think that the phrase that we came up with encapsulates the single subject.
Yeah, I'm not really convinced by the petition. I don't think it's surreptitious, but I guess the only thing that concerns me is I think there could be voters out there who would like full-strength beer and wine in grocery stores, but maybe not want to limit the ability of a store to sell 3-2 if they so chose. And here they can't even convert their license to a food store and opt to sell 3-2 because 3-2 will be eliminated. And you know, historically Colorado divided up that sale of 3-2 to 18 and 20, you know, versus 18 and 21 year olds. And, you know, I could potentially see, I guess, a grocery store on a college campus thinking that it was responsible to sell 3-2, but they didn't want to sell full strength. So that one's the only one that kind of bothers me, that there may be some people who would want to vote for one without the other, and the subjects could be divided. But I think it's still close enough that it makes it. But I guess for the record, that was the only part of the petition that sort of concerned me, is voters who may want one and not the other.
I agree that there's a single subject, and in my view, it's, while what we anticipate the voters might want or not, I think is relevant. I think what's more relevant is whether we think that the subject is a single one and encompasses fairly what the initiative proposes to do. And I think those criteria are satisfied here.
All right, then I think we can just move to the drafting.
Madam Chair, if I could,
sure.
I understand you are likely about to adopt the same changes, and I think that's generally right. I would suggest there is one change in wording that I believe would address Ms. Eubanks' concerns, at least in part. 51 concerns only full-strength beer and wine. 52 really concerns all beer, and so if the board chose to strike full-strength, the couple of places that it's present, three places I think that it's present, four places, that would certainly be accurate and may address that concern in part.
So you would want us to maintain the use beer and wine, but just remove full strength?
Yes, I think that would be appropriate on line one. I think it would be appropriate on line three.
Right, understood.
Well, I was just going through it because I think there's one place that
you'd still
want to. You'd still want full strength, and I think that would be on line.
Right. Okay.
10.
Well, as I understand the nature of the objection is that using the term beer and wine is a problem because it's not a term used in the language of the initiative or an existing law.
And while I appreciate your effort, and if the board wants to make this change as proposed by Mr. Rogers, that's fine. But, yeah, that doesn't overcome my objection in terms of I think you should be using the terminology in the liquor code.
Yeah, and my concern is that if this goes up to the court and they disagree with our understanding that this is not a slogan, you know, tinkering with the language in the way you suggested wouldn't necessarily address that. So I'm not sure
certainly
we gain much.
Completely address it.
Right.
Yeah,
I'd rather leave full strength because I still think that that is fundamentally the change that we're making, regardless of the licensing nuances.
Well, you'll...
Because we sell beer and wine.
But you'll recall that the single subject statement, and I know that Stephen pulled up 51, is actually different on 52.
Right.
I mean, it's the sale of 3-2 beer. I mean, there should be, as it appears on the screen, there should be the sale of 3-2 beer, comma, full strength beer, comma, and wine. For off-premises consumption is the statement of single subject, I believe, as we set for 52. Now, I understand, I believe, Mr. Rogers' suggestion that we just eliminate the distinction between the 3-2 and full-strength beer. We just say concerning the sale of beer and wine. Is that?
That's correct.
Yeah. And while while I understand that, it doesn't get rid of my objection.
Right. That's my concern.
Right. And so whether the title board wants to do that or not, that's one issue. But I will still have my objection that I think the terminology should be based on the statute.
Okay, I'm not inclined to change it.
Yeah, I'm not either.
But I appreciate the suggestion.
Especially not to satisfy someone who's not going to be satisfied anyway.
Difficult.
No, that's your job. Okay, so should we move to the other portions of the motion that we did grant in part in the previous title?
So we have the 25%.
So I don't know, do you want to proceed that we actually do specific motions in terms of the changes, or can we just do, incorporate them?
No,
give
that's...
notice in terms of what those changes are, that because the rest of what we did for 51 is now being shown on the screen for 52.
Yes. I do think we probably need to move the changes once they're in there, but then, yes.
Okay. So there was the change on the to specify 25%.
And we added the extra license.
Oh, are those already on the screen?
Yeah.
Oh, Stephen, you were working behind the scenes. I didn't.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm behind the eight ball here. Okay.
Either side have any comment to what's on the screen? That look like what we... I'll read it.
Other than it does have the additional phrase at the end about eliminating the 3-2 beer license
so
for off-premises consumption.
The way it reads, incorporating the changes from last time and the changes that were already in the changes from the last question we did this morning and the changes that we had made to distinguish these two titles last time, it currently reads, a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning the sale of 3.2 beer, full-strength beer, and wine for off-premises consumption and in connection therewith, creating a license allowing food stores to sell malt and vinous liquors commonly referred to as full-strength beer and wine for off-premises consumption, defining a food store as an establishment that earns at least 25% of its annual gross income from the sale of food, allowing a food store that holds a valid license to sell fermented malt beverages commonly referred to as 3-2 beer to apply to become a food store licensee and, if granted, to sell full-strength beer and wine regardless of the food store's proximity to a school, allowing the ownership of multiple food store licenses including by the owners of certain retail liquor licenses, prohibiting the sale of full-strength beer or wine by a food store employee who is under 21 years of age, and as of January 1, 2019, eliminating licenses to sell 3-2 beer for off-premise consumption.
So are we ready for a motion? Okay. The motion would be that in regard to the motion for rehearing on initiative number 52, that we grant the motion in regard to the issues that we took actions on and were incorporated on number 51, and deny the motion as to all other issues.
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion is granted. So for scheduling, what else do you have, Sharon?
Number 40 is next on Sharon's list.
That one you have, and then the rest are Jason's? Why don't we do number 40 then? Number 40 is local governance. That is measure 2015-2016, number 40. If the proponent could please come forward, introduce yourself and your proponents.
Hello, my name is Elizabeth Como. I'm the attorney for the proponents who are present. Jeffrey Dean Roybal and Marilee Matza.
All right, and do you want to start out just, why don't you give us a little history, because I know we've been here before, and if you could just state what you believe the single subject of your proposal is.
Yes, I prepared a schema showing the text of 40, and on the right, the concepts that we're trying to emphasize in this presentation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is this language is almost identical to 2013-2014 number 75, which the title board in that session drafted a quite different statement of the single subject, and it was challenged all the way through the Supreme Court, and the title board's action was upheld. I note in the legislative drafting manual that typically the staff draft comports with the previous draft unless there's some reason to change it. So I'm curious what, you know, if we could discuss what the reasons for changing it or perhaps it simply slipped notice in the drafting process. The understanding of the proponents who have drafted this is that it belongs in the Colorado Bill of Rights, the source of all government by the people, and that the Bill of Rights section, or I should say Article 2 of the state constitution, emphasizes that the constitution is a limitation on the powers of government, a reservation of the rights of the people. The various sections of proposed Initiative 40 are structured in such a way to support the subject as the proponents understood it, which is the inherent and inalienable right of the people, the right of local self-government, consistent with their membership or their residence in a political territory known as a county or a municipality. The second section describes the measures that must be included in a locally enacted law for that locally enacted law to implement what is defined in the first section as the inalienable right of the people of local self-government. And section 3 is intended to address enforceability of such a locally enacted law and conditions on that enforceability. The conditions in 3A and B would colloquially be talked about as proposed Initiative 40 only allows the people in a local community to raise the ceiling of existing rights and protections of natural persons, their communities, and nature. It does not allow for lowering the floor of existing rights and protections. If it meets those conditions, then according to this text, the locally enacted law that contains the provisions or addresses the topics listed in subsection 2 for implementation would then be enforceable despite existing preemption jurisdiction. So this is placed in the Bill of Rights as a limitation on government to change the dynamics of how these locally enacted laws are currently addressed. Each of the provisions are carefully drafted in subsection 2 and subsection 3 to unlock the power or the rights of the people to exercise what is recognized in subsection 1 as the inherent and inalienable right of people of local community self-government. Without any of those provisions, which are necessary and properly interrelated with each other and with the subject that we understand as the right of the people, the inalienable right of the people of local self-government, that right cannot be exercised.
We're going to take up the single subject first. So does anyone have any questions on?
I don't.
Okay. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the single subject? Go ahead. Mr. Kaufman.
Hi. May it please the board. My name is Richard Kaufman of Riley, Carlock, and Applewhite. And I'm appearing today on behalf of the Colorado Petroleum Council, which is a division of the American Petroleum Institute. And my remarks are much broader than that, than just representing the oil and gas industry. I think Initiative 40, whether intended or not, has many, many different subjects that I think the board should consider and then should reject this initiative. I realize that we've been around the block on this before. Last year, I believe, was Initiative 75. But I think that what this does is it establishes a new relationship between citizens and their county governments, as opposed to their relationship to the state government, and let alone the federal international government, I guess the United Nations and other international bodies, in that the state is no longer the primary relationship between the citizens and its government. It also, on a different subject, it completely changes, as never before contained, and I don't think it's clear in this matter, or in this measure, that it changes the relationship between the governments itself. The state is no longer supreme. The local governments are. And that's a separate subject in this matter. It also goes on to define what it calls inherent right to local self-government as the right to enact laws that protect health, safety, and welfare by recognizing and establishing rights of natural persons, their local communities, and nature, unquote. That provision alone contains several subjects, including the undefined rights of natural persons, the undefined rights of local communities, and the undefined rights of nature. So those are three additional subjects that I don't believe are related in this matter. I think, too, that whether intended or not, this changed drastically. This initiative drastically changes the authority to draft laws for every single subject of law that we now find in the Colorado Revised Statutes, including anything governing domestic relations, water rights, or higher education. Now, it doesn't say that on its face, but I think if you look at it, local government would trump whatever the state wants to do on any issue. Therefore, all these other issues that the state normally deals with and subjects that the state deals with in the Colorado Revised Statutes are now transferred primary authority to local government. The reference to business corporations and other business entities begins with the word including, which can only be interpreted as a specific reference to those entities, but is not limited to those alone. Therefore, all these other subjects I mentioned are involved in this, and this creates a totally separate subject from merely local governance. The right of nature is a subject unto itself. It's not defined, and it's never been recognized in law in this state. Section 3 is, again, a completely different subject. It redefines preemption law and makes local government supreme, and it is presently a subject being considered by, as I think most people here know, by the Colorado Supreme Court in the context of initiated municipal bans and moratoria on oil and gas activity that has already been invalidated by the state courts. It also adds a new word which was not in 75, and that is the term nullification. Now, I think everybody remembers what the John C. Calhoun and his idea of nullification from almost 200 years ago over the slavery issue, but it's ill-defined here, and it's a separate subject as to what nullification may or may not mean, and what it means in relation to international, federal, state, and local government. I also would believe that there's a lurking in this, unspoken but lurking and coiled within this, is we have a government right now of separation of powers. We have executive, judicial, and legislative branches of government. That would be ended by this proposal, and I know the merits may not be exactly what the board is going to go into, but it does end that relationship in that local government now is supreme. And in fact, under this proposal, I think if you read the language carefully, if the Supreme Court of Colorado came down with a decision, the local governments could override it in a subject area. This is a very broad stroke initiative. So those kinds of relationships between judicial, executive, and legislative branches, which would be is a totally different subject, and as the board can imagine, is an incredibly involved subject, is another subject that is lurking in this proposal. I can go on as far as 140-106-3C, but I believe we're just dealing with single subject right now. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. May I respond?
Sure.
I don't believe Mr. Kaufman, with all due respect, has raised any issue that was not raised before the Colorado Supreme Court in that review of 75. I wanted to mention the Fort Collins and Longmont oral argument before the Colorado Supreme Court last Wednesday, which you referenced. And this has nothing to do with that in terms of legal analysis. This is about the inalienable right of the people to local community self-government. The people outside the Colorado Supreme Court before the oral argument were talking about their inalienable rights. It is not an issue before the Colorado Supreme Court in the Longmont and Fort Collins cases. They were interpreting the Home Rule Amendment, which has essentially become a challenge in hair splitting on how to articulate the overriding preemption of home rule legislation and charter amendments in Colorado. The argument defending the current analysis acknowledged that there's only been one case in which a home rule enactment could survive state preemption. The problem that communities are having in Colorado that raises the absolute necessity of changing the Colorado State Constitution's Bill of Rights includes the problem of the people having absolutely no access to legislative changes that might implement their majority will, because certain industries have control of the legislature under Citizens United and a long tradition of control. So the people are attempting to exercise what's left to them of the right of the people to alter or amend the structure of their government. The current Bill of Rights in the state constitution, derived from the Declaration of Independence, as was required for Colorado to become a state, the U.S. Congress required the people to include the provisions of the Declaration of Independence. And Section 1 of the Colorado State Bill of Rights says that all political powers vested in and derived from the people, all government of right originates from the people. Section 2, that includes the right to alter and abolish their constitution and form of government whenever they may need it necessary.
But at this point, we're only concerned with the single subject.
I'm sorry.
At no point are we concerned with the merit of your proposal.
Right. Thank you. Thank you.
Just as to the single subject.
I'm sorry. You push a button and I go. I'm really sorry. In terms of whether it's single subject, the schema that I handed out is what was adopted by the Colorado Supreme Court in reviewing Section 75. Mr. Kaufman noted that we did add the term nullification after preemption, and we believe that that is clarifying that the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution is also implicated in this proposal, and that we do not know of any controlling precedent controlling court who has had to face the question of whether the U.S. Constitution, any of its terms, would overrule a right of the people that preexisted any constitution on this continent. The inalienable right of self-determination is a simple example would be I can say, you can't smoke in my house. And we're simply saying that the people of a community could say you cannot do something to us without our consent. If the majority of the community agrees, then that should be respected, provided that they undertake the arduous task of including in their local enactment the kinds of provisions that have to confront the policies that currently exist in law that are keeping local communities from governing themselves. None of these provisions can be deleted without preventing people from exercising an inalienable right of local community self-government. So this measure is proposed for the people of Colorado to consider whether they want to change their structure of government in this fashion.
I don't. I think I understand the arguments on single subject. Okay. Are we ready to? Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't. I mean, we can just have a discussion and then do the rehearing in one, unless you want to move that it's not.
No. No. I'm just saying I think I've heard enough. That's all.
Right. Is everyone satisfied that it's a single subject?
I am.
Okay. Then.
So I move that we find that proposed initiative number 40 contains a single subject and we proceed to set a title.
I second.
All right. So my understanding is the title we have is the one that was approved by the court. Oh, yeah. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
It's unanimous. Thank you. So my understanding is the title we have is the one that was approved when it went back as initiative 75.
No, actually, I believe the staff draft is not the title that the Supreme Court approved on number 75, and that was part of Ms. Como's communications. And it's my understanding that it wasn't caught, that 40 was based on a previous measure.
Oh, okay.
And so we apologize. I totally agree with Ms. Como that I think perhaps it might be more useful to start with
75
with 75.
And the titles for 75 are included in the board packet, and if the board will permit me just a moment, I can bring up 75 from
yes.
the
last. That would be session. Helpful. I agree with that approach. Thanks.
So what the board has currently listed as number 40 is the title as was set for 2013-2014, number 75.
Okay. All right. Does the proponent have any comments on this title?
I don't know that you would want to address any change other than perhaps the term nullification. And as a preference of the proponents, the staff draft for 75 actually had a phrase at the end. Oh, where is it? I mean, the staff draft for 40 actually had a new phrase at the end that we think is clarifying to the public without the phrase and that do not weaken I'm looking now at the revision to the staff draft of 75 that I submitted, if you can find that. Declaring that such local laws are not subject to federal, state, or international preemption, this is the important part, when such local laws do not restrict fundamental constitutional or international rights of natural persons, communities, or nature, and do not weaken their protections found in federal, state, or international law. That's perhaps a little cumbersome, but the point is a reference to subparagraphs A and B under Section 3, which the title board last cycle decided to leave out reference to, but I think it misconstrues this measure if we don't reference that concept of you can't lower the floor of existing rights and protections. Otherwise, or possibly just leaving the title as you did last year would be acceptable to us.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Kaufman, do you have anything on the title?
I have a question for Ms. Como. And just in terms of, I know there were some minor terminology changes mm-hmm. between 75 and 40.
Yes.
And one of them that I'm wondering about whether we need to change is the reference to individuals. It's my understanding that 40 uses the term natural persons.
It means the same thing. We just are trying to clarify that we're not talking about corporate personhood, so-called.
Okay. So you're fine with still using the reference to
individuals? Oh, I see. Thank you very much. To track the language of 40, it should say natural persons.
Okay. So I would propose making the change on line 4 to strike individuals and insert natural persons. And I would move that change.
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
And then I think another change that probably needs to be made based on the fact that 40 includes the terminology about nullification, that on line 7, after preemption, we insert, I think it should be, or nullification. And I would move that change.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
I don't really know what legal significance it has, but we like the term a right of local self-government rather than right to. It just feels closer to the heart. and the language of this proposal says a right of, if you're willing to humor us on that.
Well, actually indicating you think it's closer to the heart is in opposite of setting a title with words that are neutral and not catchphrases.
I see what you're saying. That's fine. That's fine. We have, I believe it tracks the language of the current 40 now, unless if you would consider adding some clarification at the end, similar to what the drafter did for the staff draft of 40. Only to local, do you want me to come up with some language? I'm actually talking about language in the staff draft that appears in lines 5 and 6 and 7, the first part of 7.
I understand that. My concern is that that was, you know, this notion of floors and ceilings was included in number 75, and that was not summarized in the title before. And I would prefer to stick with the approach of the approved title from the previous initiative.
Yeah, I'm not inclined to put in a change that's not reflected in a change in the content to just start redrafting a new.
Well, I mean, there are some exceptions to the preemption.
There were some very important exceptions, and people may read this and think, well, we don't want to go back to sundowner laws in a local community or something outrageous. And we've been very careful to make sure that there's a break on what I referred to last year as a rogue local community. That's not at all what we have intended.
I understand.
And I don't know that I would be advocating necessarily all the language that Ms. Como was suggesting, but whether or not we might be able to at least recognize that there are some exceptions to the fact that local governments aren't subject to preemption or nullification by just saying except in certain circumstances or certain situations, just to add that at the end to recognize that there would be some exceptions to that general rule. But if the board's not so inclined, that's fine.
I'm not really inclined to.
No, given that the substance, I think, is similar enough across the two initiatives from different years, I'm not inclined to depart from what the Supreme Court approved in a previous year.
Okay. All right, so let me read it. It's an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning a right to local self-government, and in connection therewith, declaring that the people have an inherent right to local self-government in counties and municipalities, including the power to enact laws to establish and protect fundamental rights of natural persons, communities, and nature, and the power to define or eliminate the rights and powers of corporations or business entities to prevent them from interfering with those fundamental rights, and declaring that such local laws are not subject to preemption or nullification by any federal, state, or international laws.
So
do we need a semicolon after nature, or no? Up in four? Or is that all one?
You could add a semicolon and eliminate and.
I don't think it should eliminate be a semicolon that. Because you're that all goes to the phrase including. So it's
okay.
Describing yeah, including the power to enact laws and the power to define or eliminate.
Okay, so do we
it's
not need anything?
Including A and B.
Okay,
right.
That's fine.
At best, I think you could have a comma there, but I don't think.
Nah, that's fine. I just thought it.
It's just
changed.
Describing.
Oh, sorry. Yep, I agree.
Okay.
I agree with
okay.
Sharon.
All right. Then do we want to?
I should mention where it says in line four to protect fundamental rights. That's another change in this version. The word fundamental, I don't think, appears in proposed 40. The third line of subsection 2 says establishing rights rather than fundamental rights. And so line 4, where it says fundamental, is not tracking the current text.
I understand. I agree with that. I think we can delete fundamental.
And I believe it reappears a line or two down in 6. And I think you've got it.
So you're gonna, did you move
yeah, I'll
that
move,
change?
Move the changes as reflected on lines 4 and 6 of the current draft.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right.
Thank you.
Are we ready for a motion?
I would move that the board adopt the title for number 40 as it appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All right, that concludes number 40. I think we'll take a break we're going to switch out, and I think we'll break for lunch come back at 12:30. Does that work? What, are you laughing
at? It's just, I was laughing at Jason.
Oh. we'll reconvene at 12:30, and we will hear the rest of the measures.